I am Jacek Kolesiński, FIU Radcliffe's Art and Design Incubator's Tech Conversations host.
Our guest today is Rashida Phillips, artist, attorney, author, and the founder of the Black Quantum Future. Welcome to our program.
Hello, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So Rashida, first question, what is Black Quantum Futurism?
So Black Quantum Futurism is a theory, it's a practice, it's an artistic collective, it's a way of thinking about and looking at the world. It is grounded in Afrofuturism and speculation, but it is also primarily concerning itself in looking at themes around housing, time, temporality, communities, and, you know, at essence, how Black people experience and think about time. And paralleling that with ideas or understandings of how quantum physics thinks about and treats time. We find a lot of correspondence and just resonance in terms of what quantum physics offers, you know, in terms of time and temporality and how it treats time and temporality that goes beyond the confines of Western linear time constructs that really cut us off from the future or cut off access or keep us Black people and marginalized people in narrow time bands that don't allow us to achieve the Afro futures that, you know, we would like to make it to or create for ourselves. So Black Quantum Futurism is really thinking about that and thinking about that through various modalities and practices and interdisciplinary practices, primarily writing, sound, installation, social practice, research, creative research, zine making, and anything, you know, we call it a life practice. It's embedded in and intertwined with our ways of living and thinking and experiencing the world. So it's wrapped up in my work as an advocate, wrapped up in various aspects of our life and art and creative practice.
You deconstruct the notion of time, and you spoke a lot about this at different podcasts and in your writing, that teleological linear time is not effective to tell the story.
Right, exactly. I mean, as a, you know, the history of the future and of time and linear time as we commonly experience it in our society or in Western societies is, you know, it has a history. It's very much grounded in or interconnected with all sorts of happenings and events throughout time and history, political, scientific, social, and otherwise, when we typically, you know, we have been sort of indoctrinated or trained to just think about time as mechanical or as something that you find on a clock and to de-emphasize subjective experiences of time or communal experiences of time that may be more beneficial to how we access the future or thrive than what Western linear time offers. And I explore that as an advocate, someone who represents people who are facing eviction and loss of their homes and how the construct of time shows up in their court cases, how it shows up in the time that they have to vacate a property before they're locked out. It shows up, you know, in every single way possible for the people who I work with and represent. And so finding alternatives to that, finding reimagining or uprooting other ways, other cultures, other traditions of time that are, again, sort of interconnected already with our Afro-diasporan ancestors or cultural practices that, you know, again, get de-emphasized or we're told are not valid ways of experiencing time or thinking about time or, yeah, so.
Visual gap was one of the things that COVID highlighted for everybody, access to internet, access to broadband. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it shows up in many ways, particularly, again, in the communities that I work with in Philadelphia, both as an artist and as an advocate. Philadelphia is one of the poorest, largest cities in the country. I think we have been the poorest, largest city in the country for a number of years. We have a very high poverty rate. The poverty rate is racially concentrated poverty. And so people who are disproportionately impacted by poverty are Black and brown people in the city, people of color. And so what that translates into is a huge digital divide that existed before COVID, but that was brought into clearer, you know, relief under COVID and understanding of how it operates. And we still continue to deal with that even almost, you know, what are we, 2 years, the year and a half into the pandemic or however long it's been. My clients who I work with, I work at an organization called Community Legal Services, have extreme issues accessing court, going to being able to go to court online, you know, over a Zoom hearing, you know, having your rights sort of deprived in that way, not being able to really truly access justice if you have to upload your documents to a portal and you have no idea, you know, you have no internet access, you don't have a laptop, you may be working from your phone may not have minutes. So these are the realities of that our clients are dealing with, and even something that under normal circumstances is quite difficult, which is like making it into a legal services office and having an intake appointment and getting some help, we now have to do that online. And so that sort of system privileges those who can make it online. And so just all of the people that we're leaving out of that system, you know, it's greatly concerning for us, but that's the circumstances that we're working with. And so it's really challenging. It's challenging for me when I'm representing a client to do even just a basic interview with that client and get the documents that I need and get documents back to them. And these are really urgent situations that people are dealing with. So it's a huge, huge barrier. And then as an artist who works, you know, so much of my work is embedded in communities, and in particular in North Philadelphia, so much of our practice as BQF is about being in communities, working with communities, collaborating, helping amplify voices. It's obviously a huge issue. And so, again, you know, we've tried to, you know, there's been some situations where we've been successful in moving events that we would normally have in person online. Like we do an annual event called Time Camp that is usually a weekend or two weekends of workshops and events and art installations related to time. So it's very much like Space Camp, but it's Time Camp. So we this year last summer moved that online as a result of the pandemic. And it really turned out beautifully. It was an opportunity to engage people across the world on these topics and to invite people across the world to present and to be there. And we had, you know, over 120 black and brown, non-binary, femmes, women, youth, trans women, all involved and all engaged through the platform. So that was really an amazing opportunity. But, you know, when it comes to other things, it's inadequate. It's absolutely inadequate. And I don't want it to be the status quo. I miss working with community members who I have built great relationships with. And again, we still do stuff online. In fact, I probably meet with them more online now that, you know, at this point, because I do a lot of community involved work. And so I set up Zoom meetings and we're meeting, you know, 3 or 4 times a month, which was different, you know, for the pandemic. We weren't meeting that often. So it has brought that opportunity, but it's absolutely not the same. And again, it leaves out people who otherwise would be able to walk in into a community meeting and sit down who can't do that because it's now online and they don't know how to access it or put the Zoom link in to be able to get onto the meeting. So the challenge is a challenge across the board, but you know, as we do, communities are making it work, and we're making it work here.
You know, another question that sort of segues from what you said. I was thinking about artificial intelligence and bias woven into the whole structure, and so what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, as an advocate, it's something that I'm working on as we speak, actually. So in Philadelphia, so again, I represent low-income tenants who are facing eviction, facing housing instability. And one thing that we see on a daily basis, right, is that people who have had evictions filed against them, even if they've never been evicted, even if they worked it out, even if it was 10 years ago, those evictions continue to show up on their record. There's no way to mask them or seal them. And what ends up happening is that landlords who qualify tenants to rent use algorithms, use these tenant screening companies that have some mysterious formula qualifying these tenants and saying whether or not it's a good tenant based on records that it's pulled that may or may not be inaccurate, or you know, maybe is being determined by an algorithm that's spitting out a score that really doesn't make sense. And so, and the landlord's using those as tools to qualify or reject tenants. And so we see in particular that eviction records tend to be filed in Black communities the most, against Black women the most. And so the people who are most likely to have eviction records are Black women. And so the people then who are most likely to be rejected when applying for housing are Black women. And that's as a result of both, you know, not even just the artificial intelligence and the algorithms, right, that plays a major role, but also people's own implicit bias, people's own individual looking at something and making a decision, whether consciously or not, that this person is going to not be a good renter, which may unconsciously be governed by the color of their skin or by other stereotypes of people, you know, who are Black, who are women, who have children, whatever the case may be. So it's absolutely an issue. Fortunately, there are ways to address it. One of the ways that we're addressing it in Philadelphia is that one of our city council members introduced a legislation called the Renters Access Act that I worked on and helped develop. And it is a protection that will, if it gets passed, say that landlords can't have policies where they're just banning people with eviction records. They have to do a individualized human review of rental applications. They cannot just rely on a tenant screening report and the score or the credit score that is kicked out by artificial intelligence or a robot or an algorithm. They have to actually sit down and look at those applications themselves. And then there's certain things that they can't look at. And so I see this really, you know, not only is it a race equity tool for the reasons that I stated, which is that Black women and their families tend to have these eviction records the most. And so they are the ones being rejected and denied access to affordable housing for the rest of their lives. So this is a race equity tool, but I also see it as one, as an Afrofuturist and as a person who works with these themes around time, as a tool that really, again, disrupts linear time, because what it's saying is that you can't just take this record and that record is just the past and you can't disrupt the past. It's saying you can disrupt the past. You can add more information to the past. You can shift the nature of that past relation, the relationship of it to the future or to the present. So you absolutely can go back into the past. And so it's just, it's both a racial equity tool, but it's an Afrofuturist time shifting tool as well. And this is, for me, where my advocacy work and Afrofuturist work and speculation work, right, which sounds like two very opposed things, come together through these kinds of policies and advocacy.
Here's the question. You're trained as a lawyer. You work as a lawyer and you work as an artist. How did the training through the law school formulate your methodology as an artist?
That's a great question. Sometimes I have said in the past that I felt disadvantaged by being trained as an attorney first and never having had any formal training as an artist. But now I think very differently about that. I think being trained as a lawyer and having first started as an advocate before I considered myself an Afrofuturist, it just has fundamentally shifted why I make my work, who I make it for, how I relate to the work, and what I think its possibilities are for the world or for shifting systems and things like that. I don't think had I done things the other way around, not that I've really had we always have a choice, but my life trajectory just did not allow me to be an artist first. I was a young parent, but I just think had it been the other way around, had I considered myself an artist first and then like not went the route of being an attorney, it would have been different. For my approach and my process, how I think and how I'm able to sort of break down reality as an attorney, or how I've been trained to think as a lawyer, really lends itself to how I write and think about science and how I think about the laws of science that allow me to feel like I can challenge them or I can break them down or unravel them and relate them back to, you know, other constructs or other. Yeah. So anyway, just to say that, yes, I do think being a lawyer lends to my process, lends to how I approach the work, fundamentally informs who and how I make my work, why I make it. And it's extremely important to me that that work be ultimately connected back to what I'm passionate about, which is being an advocate for, you know, folks who, you know, folks from my community and folks like me and folks who have been disenfranchised or marginalized by systems and structures in society.
So Rashida, this year you received the Knight Foundation grant for a 2021 Art Tech Fellowship. So what are the projects that you're going to do under the auspices of that grant?
Yeah, so a lot of different things. You know, this the grant is able to support. So, and some of it is projects that I'm that are sort of interconnected. You know, they're not like specific clean or new projects. One of the things that I'm working on is I have a fellowship through Buralist Center called Time Zone Protocols, which is looking at protocols and laws and rules around time and temporality. In particular, looking at the Prime Meridian Conference, where the world's Prime Meridian was recommended to be Greenwich, as well as like the year before, the U.S. time zones were standardized, and just looking at those different temporal constructs. And so I want to build a digital project around that particular project that the Knights funding will be able to support that. You know, and we're also doing a residency with CERN in Geneva around
the Hadron Collider, right?
Yeah. So it's an artistic fellowship that we'll be doing there and creating new work there. So we'll obviously support that as well. So a lot of things in the works, and you know, it's amazing to be recognized with that, and it allows us also to support again this work that we're doing in communities and supporting, you know, and amplifying issues around housing in particular and other issues that through a racial justice lens.
So any other closing remarks you would want to give our listeners about your upcoming projects?
I would just say check out our website. We got a bunch of websites, actually. You can check out blackquantumfuturism.com. We have another website that is particularly about our Community Futures Lab project, which originated in North Philly, but has its own website called futureslab.community, which is also an interactive site. Where people can sign up and you can memory map. You can do a lot of different things on that website. And we also have a website called blackwomantemporal.net. So all of these websites are interactive. There's lots of different information on there, and you can keep up with our various projects and events that we have going on.
Well, thank you so much for your time. And I hope we can see each other in 3D at some point. And anytime you're in Miami, Radcliffe is open for the visit, so hope to see you here soon.
Appreciate it. Nice to meet you.
Same here. Thank you.
Bye.